Our top stories, both counting for the contentious U.S. presidential election, drags on for a third day as the winner remains unclear. U.S. President Trump's campaign files a new lawsuit on what it calls voting irregularities in Nevada after losing court rulings in Georgia and Michigan states. And a UK Parliament watchdog says Britain's trade ties with the EU faces major disruption, regardless of whether a trade deal is agreed. Vote counting for the U.S. presidential election enters a third day with no clear winner in the race for the White House. In the state of Georgia, some 99% of the votes have been counted. Democratic candidate Joe Biden is leading over incumbent President Donald Trump by over 1,000 votes there. Biden is also leading in the states of Nevada and Arizona, but he is behind Trump in Pennsylvania and North Carolina. All these states are key battleground states that are yet to declare a clear winner in the presidential election. The delay is because American states have different laws on counting mail-in ballots. Friday is the last deadline for mail-in votes to be counted. Well, U.S. President Trump has once again hurled accusations at Democrats claiming they're engaging, or I should say engineering, the presidential election.
And there are many instances which will be reported very shortly. There's tremendous litigation going on, and this is a case where they're trying to steal an election. They're trying to rig an election, and we can't let that happen. Detroit and Philadelphia, known as two of the most corrupt political places anywhere in our country.
Trump added that if, quote, legal votes are counted, he will easily win the presidential race. He once again lashed out at the mail-in voting system, calling it a one-sided method that benefits Democrats. The Trump campaign has filed lawsuits to halt vote counting in Nevada, Michigan, Wisconsin, as well as Pennsylvania, while claiming vote irregularities in Georgia. State judges in Georgia and Michigan, however, have rejected the suits, citing lack of evidence. In the meantime, Democratic candidate Biden expressed confidence that he will be elected as the next U.S. president after the vote counting process ends.
We have no doubt that when the count is finished, Senator Harris and I will be declared the winners. So I ask everyone to stay calm, all the people to stay calm. The process is working. The count is being completed.
The Democratic candidate stressed that each ballot must be counted. The race is tight in Georgia, Nevada, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. Biden needs only six more electoral votes to secure the 270 needed to win the nail-biter race. Trump has so far won 214. Final results can take days to be announced, as counting mail-in ballots is set to be a time-taking process. Republicans are divided over Trump's allegations of election fraud and his demand for stopping the vote count. Senator Mitt Romney said counting every vote is at the heart of democracy. He said the process is often long and frustrating, but that does not mean it should stop. Republican representative for Illinois Adam Kinzinger said Trump should stop spreading debunked misinformation. Maryland Governor Larry Hogan said there is no defense for Trump's post-election comments and urged him to respect the results. That's while two other Republican senators have supported the president. Ted Cruz said Pennsylvania's attorney general had ordered vote counting to continue, that is, in Philadelphia until Joe Biden wins. Lindsey Graham also said Philadelphia elections are crooked. Rival rallies have been held across the nation, that is the United States, for the second straight night over the election vote count. President Trump supporters, some with weapons, gathered outside the vote counting facility in Las Vegas. That's the most populous city in the state of Nevada, where election ballots are still being processed. Trump supporters included members of the far-right group Proud Boys. They carried flags that say, "Do not steal my vote." Pro-Trump supporters gathered in New York and Philadelphia, too. Both cities also saw rival protests calling for every vote to be counted. The demonstrations were triggered on Wednesday after Trump claimed that he had been cheated out of winning the election. He has offered no evidence for that claim. 17 states across the United States have reported record daily increases of COVID-19 infections. as the country registers a record number of over 123,000 new cases. Number of hospitalized patients continue to rise for the 11th day in a row, reaching over 52,500. Furthermore, the country's average daily fatalities also rose to 850, I should say. Some cities and states have taken measures to curb the virus surge by imposing curfews of reducing gathering sizes. However, 17 out of 50 American states, that should be, do not have mandatory mask laws. The pandemic has spread across the country, but has affected the Midwest worse. Illinois and Texas are leading states in number of cases in the last 7 days. Now, the World Health Organization says an explosion of COVID-19 cases is seen in Europe, while mortality rates are also rising in the continent. Earlier, we discussed that matter in detail with our guests in our news review program.
The World Health Organization says an explosion of COVID-19 cases is seen in Europe, while mortality rates are also rising in the continent. The WHO's regional director for Europe warned that in only a couple of days there will be an increase of 1 million cases in the continent. Hans Kolsch also noted that the mortality rate is also rising, but at a slower pace. European governments have implemented strict lockdown measures to stem the second wave of the pandemic. On Thursday, the continent emerged as accounting for the largest number of infections in the world. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent Jerm Hughes from Brussels and also Robert Inlakish, our other correspondent live from London. Thanks to both of you. Let's begin from Brussels. And Jerm Hughes, if you could give us an update on the situation there, first-hand information which you're experiencing right now.
Yeah, well, you know, it's very interesting what's happening here in Belgium, because we just don't know yet if the restrictions that were implemented about 3 weeks ago, you know, this was the first country in the region to start implementing very heavy restrictions in terms of closing down cafes and restaurants and so on. A lot of people very upset about that. Some people saying the restrictions go too far. Others are saying they weren't implemented quickly enough. And if you do it sooner, then you start getting the cases down quicker. But, you know, here it's hard to know whether that's working, because if you look at the figures, I mean, today, Thursday, we had new figures out this morning, 15,000 additional cases, 205 additional deaths. But if you look back, say, the 31st of October, what was that, Saturday? So, you know, you're talking then there were around 20,000 cases. And then it slowly went down, and you had something like 14, then 11. A couple of days ago, we had just 5,000 new coronavirus cases here in Belgium. And it's back up again to 15. Maybe today's a bit of a blip on the graph. Could be to do with the amount of testing and so on. Maybe we are seeing a downward curve since the 31st of October, and maybe that is because of these restrictions 3 weeks ago. But it'll take another week or so to figure out if this is a trend going downwards and whether these lockdowns really are having the effect that the authorities want. But, I mean, elsewhere, France, as you mentioned earlier, you know, an extra 40,500 cases, 385 additional deaths. I know you're going to be talking about the UK, but, you know, an extra 25,000 plus cases in Spain and the UK, a lot of deaths there as well. And Italy, 30,500 additional cases, 352 deaths. And if you move away sort of from the western part of the continent, then, I mean, Poland, you mentioned also 27,000 additional cases, 367 additional deaths. Czech Republic is not doing well either, 16,000 new cases. So it is a situation that is out of control, and it's all linked to your previous story that you mentioned before you came to the news review in relation to the economic impact. And many people are saying, you're hearing forecasts from the European Commission, you're hearing forecasts from the European Central Bank about things won't be back to pre-COVID status until 2023. Well, if you speak to a lot of economists, they're saying that's way overly optimistic, because we just don't know how bad this is going to get in terms of how long we need to lock down, how long the lockdowns are going to continue for, will we get a third wave, will we get a fourth wave? So economic predictions at this point are pretty fruitless, futile, you could say.
Thank you very much, Jerome. Let's go to London and talk to Robert and Rakesh to find out what's happening exactly in London right now and in the UK, basically.
Well, what we do know, of course, is that there was a reported 492 COVID-19 deaths, according to the most authoritative sources, yesterday. And, of course, this comes in line with predictions that perhaps if the government didn't do anything in the country, we could reach 4,000 deaths a day. These projections put forth by SAGE, which is a scientific advisory organization to the government. However, with that, we've had members of SAGE come out and say that perhaps these projections were a little bit too high. And amongst the population going into the lockdown today, there is a huge divide in terms of people that think this should have been done sooner, that the government should have acted sooner, and also that the government should have taken harsher measures now as well with the second lockdown that we're going into. And on the other side, a lot of people are very concerned about what this means for the British economy going into a second lockdown. We've seen that the new infections are up just 1.9%. From last week. That is a rise, of course, and the British government claims to have been doing something about this, but many people are disputing, you know, whether this is actually going to make any sort of tangible difference in the country, as, for instance, the places where we're seeing most of these cases rise are still open, and there's been little to no restrictions on many different areas where there is the biggest spikes in COVID-19 spread. I believe that many people at the moment are, and on both sides, against the government and what it has been implemented. People, of course, are very anxious about the potential of, you know, going up above what was happening in May in terms of the death statistics and also the infections that we saw back then. But even SAGE has said it is not likely that we will surpass what happened in May. And also, I'd like to note that back in May as well, people said that the government should have locked down quicker and it didn't act quick enough. So at the moment, we're seeing a lot of pushback against the government for the way that it's handled the situation, and also a lot of contradictory information that we hear coming out from Premier Boris Johnson. So it's all a bit of a mess at the moment in the United Kingdom, and a lot of people are now fearing what comes next.
Thank you very much, Robert Inlakish, our correspondent from London, and Jerome Hughes from Brussels. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for the elaborations, and thanks for following this edition of the News Review.
Welcome back. UK Parliament watchdog says Britain's trade with the European Union faces major disruption regardless of whether a trade deal is agreed. The National Audit Office said ports and businesses are not ready for January the 1st when the Brexit transition period ends. The body said the UK government is attempting to prepare new border controls which pose high risks. The office added that the coronavirus pandemic will make the situation even worse. London and Brussels are engaged in intensive talks to work out their future trade ties. The prospects for a deal looks dim. Looked dim, that should be, as lots of moot points remain. U.S. administration has reportedly notified the Congress that it plans to sell sophisticated armed aerial drones to the United Arab Emirates. The sale includes 18 of such drones in a deal worth nearly $3 billion. That's according to Reuters, citing people briefed on the notification. Reuters says the notification is informal and the State Department should later send a formal one to Congress. But before that department does so, its weapons sales can be reviewed by the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Senate and House. Both committees even have the ability to block the sales. Their members have already criticized the UAE's role in civilian deaths in the Yemen war last week. The U.S. administration also notified Congress of a potential sale of F-35 fighter jets to the UAE. Now, two prominent human rights groups have condemned the confirmation that Formula One is to hold a race in Saudi Arabia next year. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have criticized the decision over the human rights situation in Saudi Arabia. Amnesty has described the country's rights record as heinous. Human Rights Watch said the next year event in Saudi Arabia is a blatant attempt at sports washing. HRW said the event is part of a cynical strategy to distract from Saudi Arabia's human rights abuses. The kingdom has long been criticized for its rights record, including the detaining and torturing human rights defenders, as well as women's rights activists. Riyadh has defied calls by international rights bodies to improve the situation. UK families calling for justice have held a rally asking for accountability and justice over the country's deaths in police custody. Our correspondent there, Richard Sudan, reports.
Deaths in custody has been and remains a serious issue of concern for many in Britain in 2020, with countless individuals continuing to die in deeply suspicious circumstances while in the custody of the police. This year, the United Friends and Family Campaign, UFFC, launched their yearly March for Justice, with this year's event taking place online due to the current COVID-19 restrictions. Despite the calls for justice continuing over many decades, police accountability and real change remain as elusive as ever, especially for black communities, which, according to the facts, are more likely to fall victim to police violence.
I think that certainly the use of force, as described by the Metropolitan Police, the extent to which they use force when arresting black people, was six times more likely. And of course, that because we're more likely to suffer mental ill health, that is always another recurring feature, overwhelming and disproportionate force, when actually what somebody needs is a caring environment, yes, restrained, but they're not criminal, they're just mentally ill. And so these are the kind of recurring factors that we see evidenced in black deaths in custody.
I'm the twin of Leon Patterson, who died in police custody in Denton in 1992, 27th of November. He was arrested on suspicion of stealing a till, which was then proved not to be the case. He was held in police custody for 6 days and was found dead in the cell on the 27th of November. The outline that I got from the chief superintendent was that Leon basically beat himself to death by throwing himself around the cell.
3 decades on from Leon Patterson's death, and like so many cases, no officer has ever been charged or brought to justice.
When we did remove the sheet from the body, I mean, it was a bit of a to-ing and fro-ing to remove the sheet, because he went, "You can't touch it." You had the morgue attendants trying to hold down the sheet, and the officer just kept standing behind me saying, "You do know this is all self-inflicted. You do know that he did this to himself." And that's when we turned him over and saw all the bruises on the back and down his legs. So to keep saying that this is all self-inflicted was mute.
The justification for black deaths in custody and the rationale behind it, you know, is all developed within the sort of racist context of a white privilege that assumes that white people can never be guilty of any sin when it comes to inflicting violence against black people. And that's an attitude and a lived experience we've lived with since we were on the plantations, way back in the 17th century. And it's continued from that day right up until this day.
Despite the calls for accountability and justice, far too many people fall victim to police violence, where far from upholding the law, they often break it with deadly consequences, knowing that they operate under a different set of laws which they themselves exist to uphold. Deaths in custody remains an issue disproportionately affecting Britain's black communities. Despite promises to enact reforms, many argue that Britain's police remains institutionally racist. Under the current government and with racism on the rise, this situation could get a lot worse. Richard Sudam, London.
And that's it with international news.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود
قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Under the Prophet's rule, Muslims reached the peak of global civilizations.
The Holy Prophet built a strong and logical foundation on the basis of which Muslims could reach the peaks of global civilizations for centuries and could rise to new heights which were unprecedented in human history. His rule did not last any more than 10 years. You just see what proportion of a nation's lifespan could those 13 years and the following 10 years constitute. It is like a moment which passes very quickly. During such a short time, a great movement was started which could well be said to have divided human history into two eras, the pre-Islamic era and the post-Islamic era. The Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, pushed humanity forwards, strengthened the basis of morality, and left unforgettable lessons for all humans.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
You should consider the greatness of Mabath and from such a perspective. There were, of course, a number of interrelated factors which led to this success. But this success was mainly due to the Prophet being full of spirituality, purity, loyalty, and relying completely on God. This was a major and decisive factor in his success. Prior to his prophethood, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, was the most knowledgeable and the wisest of the people of Mecca. He was the most generous, respectable, and decent person in the area where he lived. Among those people, this prominent person enjoyed the blessing of God and the responsibility was put on his shoulders. This was because God had put him to the test before. God knew his servant and knew who he was assigning this responsibility to.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Ministry. The U.S. elections on the 3rd of November are keeping the whole world on tenterhooks as to whether Donald Trump will be re-elected as Republican president or whether, on the contrary, it will be the Democratic candidate Joe Biden who will win the election. But how could a second Trump term or a first Biden presidency affect the Middle East? Despite the obvious differences between Trump and Biden, there will be few foreign policy changes in the region. In matters of foreign policy, the reports of the Pentagon and the Council on Foreign Relations point out that the current and future challenges facing the U.S. and the region are to contain the Islamic Republic of Iran, to settle the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, support the allies in the Persian Gulf and Egypt and Jordan, stabilize the situation in Libya and Iraq, and attempt to put an end to the alliances between Syria and Russia and Iran. Under this scenario, the next U.S. administration's prospects in the Middle East will be based on strengthening relations with Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Egypt while maintaining a more combative position with Iran. Now, the current president has gone one step further and has even assured that he is not popular in the Pentagon, and this organization seeks only to be at war and be able to spend millions of dollars on arms purchases. For their part, the Pentagon's top officials considered that a precipitous departure of the troops could endanger, wait for it, peace in Iraq and Afghanistan. This might signal that the upcoming U.S. administration will advocate leaving what the Pentagon calls a residual force in Iraq and Afghanistan as a preventive measure against, wait for it again, terrorism. President Trump turned American foreign policy inside out to the benefit of some nations and dismay of others. Now, both groups are watching attentively to see which direction the U.S. goes next. However, West Asia is not holding its breath while the U.S. chooses its leader, simply because they've already been there and done that, and no good ever comes out of it. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. On the eve of the 2020 U.S. presidential election, it remains to be seen whether the Middle East is going to be used to galvanize support for a conservative nationalist foreign policy. In 2016, for instance, Trump's campaign often invoked the Middle East as a region where the U.S. has needlessly squandered blood and treasure. Furthermore, in September 2015, Trump pledged to deport all Syrian refugees, most of whom are Muslim, from the United States. Whereas for his re-election campaign, a paradox seems to be unfolding, with Trump touting his successes in the region as a peace broker. To discuss this issue with us from London is Mr. Patrick Henningsen, who is the founder of the 21st Century Wire. Thank you for being with us, Patrick. Now, for all its stated desire to disentangle itself from the Middle East or the region of West Asia, Washington has really a hard time letting go here. But Biden and Trump represent two markedly different futures for some of the region's political elites in West Asia, especially their leadership in the Israeli entity and in a clutch of oil-rich Arab monarchies. How do you think the results will affect the region of West Asia?
Well, I think on the surface, it might look like they will present two different possibilities, two different scenarios for the Middle East. But if you look at U.S. history, what you'll find is from administration to administration, there's an incredible level of continuity between administrations that might appear to be being from different parties, for instance, or different personalities, totally different, but really the underlying policy is very slow moving in the United States. In the current situation, looking at Syria, looking at Iraq, for instance, there's definitely a drift away from previous policies by the U.S., so they're moving out, essentially, in the larger scheme of things. So, in terms of the Israeli issue, I don't see a massive difference that will happen between a Biden administration and the Trump administration. I think, who knows, the Biden administration could be more beholden to the Israeli lobby or as beholden as the Trump administration. I don't see any noises being made otherwise. Certainly there's some to be gained with some of these other issues at play, like the JCPOA, but I'm not convinced there's going to be a massive difference.
Well, a new U.S. administration could signal a dramatic reversal of Trump's old policies in the region, where it's believed that it would seek maybe to patch the damage that he caused with the Islamic Republic of Iran, especially with the nuclear JCPOA deal, and maybe cool the tensions down. But why should Iran trust any U.S. president if, let alone in 4 years from now, a new Republican president could come to office and just revoke another agreement?
Well, you've hit the nail right on the head, Marwa. They shouldn't. And I think Iran has learned this lesson. The Islamic Republic of Iran has learned this lesson already. And I think they're moving ahead with their future, with their plans. They should be looking to China to be doing more economic and political deals with China. They should be looking to Russia. They should be looking to their near neighbors as well, looking to strengthen their relationship with Iraq, for instance. And who knows, down the road, there could be better relations between Iran and maybe even some of the Gulf states, possibly, down the road. So I think Iran had made its position known in the last 24 months that it is prepared to defend itself. It's prepared to, wield its own influence within its sphere, within its regional sphere. So the United States knows this very well, and hence that's why you're seeing the U.S. drifting out of the Middle East. Trump has made this a big part of his campaign. We're pulling out, he said, multiple times. So if a Biden administration comes in, the Democrats favor proxy wars. They favor gray area subterfuge, whereas the Republicans like to do things kind of on top, over the table. So there's a different style in terms of intervention or flexing muscle internationally, but at the end of the day, the policy is very similar. And the overall trend to me seems the United States is withdrawing its forces, its heavy assets, its soldiers, for instance, from the region, because it's just there's no appetite for it in America right now, certainly for this election cycle. There isn't. But if Trump gets reelected, who knows? Things could change in a year. But low oil prices, very important for this president. As far as the Biden administration goes, I see maybe more similar to an Obama administration or Hillary Clinton style approach.
Patrick, you also touched the main issue here, because the experience of West Asia with the different U.S. Administrations, that they are always hostile to the axis of resistance nations. Their hostility is deep-rooted, and there will be no shift, basically, in U.S. foreign policy, especially for West Asia, which is basically aimed at harming civilians, whether through direct wars or through sanctions, which are equally as hostile as wars. However, do you think by continuing this Genghis style foreign policy, the U.S. will actually be securing its own benefits in the region?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think things are changing, and the current economic situation in the world, the United States' economy is very fragile. They can't afford high oil prices. People are struggling. Businesses are struggling to make ends meet. So low fuel prices is a big feature in that right now. Certainly, a Democratic administration, they're looking for, to wean off of fossil fuels and to, move into the green economy. So the Green New Deal, that means higher fuel prices, maybe a drop in demand in terms of oil and so forth. But, the U.S. is pretty energy independent at the moment. That could change. So the need to intervene and the need to micromanage every single aspect of the Middle East is no longer at the top of their priority list as it was maybe 20 or, 30, 20, 10, 15 years ago. So things have changed in that respect. I think that's overall good news for the region, but there's still problems that exist. The Israeli lobby dictates a Biden-Harris administration. Kamala Harris is very much aligned with AIPAC. I think they would continue very similar policies to the Trump administration.
Well, it's very hard. One very critical foreign policy issue that has almost been entirely absent from the Biden-Trump debates is Iraq, and with it, the U.S. role in the entire rest of Asia. Now, the United States, maybe its place in the world has been greatly shaped, especially over the last 17 years. by its presence in Iraq, do you think that maybe after this election with a new U.S. administration, the U.S. will actually rethink its illegal presence in Iraq?
Yes, I think that's already happening. I think that's already happening. It's a quagmire that there is really no long-term solution for the United States. I mean, they'll continue to have a presence there, possibly, but really, I think against the overall will of the people in Iraq. So they'll be meddling, certainly in Iraqi Kurdistan, for geostrategic reasons. I think overall, I don't see at least in the near term, 5 or 10 years, I don't see a big future for the United States on any level in Iraq. And they know that it's only going to exacerbate and cause problems. And Iraq knows that they're not going to be able to stamp out terrorism and fight ISIS with the United States marshaling and micromanaging everything in their country. So they're much more effective. They've shown that. I think even people, realists in Washington, realize that the Iraqis, with the help of Iran, did a tremendous job in rooting ISIS out of the country, whereas the United States has always not been terribly effective in that respect.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire, for joining us to talk about what the U.S. election means for West Asia. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned next for more about this matter. As the U.S. presidential election was approaching, President Donald Trump has been pressing more Arab countries to normalize relations with Israel. With the prospects for further normalization are expected to become more challenging next year, future challenges facing the U.S. in the region, as per the Pentagon, are to further pressure Iran, attempt to stabilize the situation in Libya and Iraq, and attempt to put an end to the alliance between Syria and Russia and Iran. U.S. presidential elections fever in West Asia in this following report.
I kept my promise, recognized the true capital of Israel, and opened the American embassy in Jerusalem.
The term reckless is often used to describe Trump's actions in the Middle East. Notably, the execution of the leader of Iran's Quds Force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, brought extreme uncertainty and raised questions over the U.S.'s approach in an already unstable region. On combating Iran, the Trump administration's reckless approach undercut American influence in the region. Instead, the Trump administration chose to draw on its military primacy to remain as an inevitable actor in the Middle East. Furthermore, the emergent normalization between Arab states and Israel comes at a time when Iran is promoted as a greater threat, and the Palestinian cause isn't considered as much of a prerequisite for peace as it was in the past. Meanwhile, as several countries come to the aid of warring factions in Libya, Trump has found himself caught in the middle of a group of strong men he's forged close ties with during his presidency, prompting him to stay out of the fray and let them fend for themselves, stepping back from any involvement in the country that the U.S. fully destroyed in 2011. Moving on to Yemen, despite the fact that Trump inherited the disaster from his predecessor Barack Obama, but the 45th president has also intensified them. There could be no doubt that Trump has contributed to making Yemen into what Human Rights Watch has described it as the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. Trump has been glad to oversee the intensification of this crisis, bombing and carrying out raids in the country periodically, as well as arming foreign states like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to aid in their own warmongering campaigns. Trump's confrontational strategy in West Asia has led to other actors intervening in the region. For instance, in Syria and Libya, Russia is playing a major role, and its resurgence in the region has partly been due to Moscow capitalizing on the U.S. change in policy towards the region. Moreover, the hastiness of American actions in the Middle East towards Trump's extrication aims has also undermined the influence of the U.S. in the region and put regional and international actors at the center of discussions. Hence, the uncertainty and impulsiveness of American decisions in West Asia are expected to only bring more doubt and divide in the foreign policy aspects of the U.S. election.
now to discuss this issue with us from Paris is Mr. Mustafa Fatouri, researcher and political writer and commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Fatouri. Now, Trump and his allies claim that his administration has achieved more in the space of a few years of Middle East politicking than what their predecessors managed over decades. That includes the recent so-called Abraham Accords that was signed between Israel and Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates, normalizing ties with the Israeli occupation. How has that affected maybe the struggle of the Palestinian natives against the Israeli occupation at the moment?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me, Marwa, on the program. And second of all, certainly the latest developments in terms of normalization of relations between the Zionist state and the United Arab Emirates or Bahrain and probably Sudan later on, it puts the Palestinians under some kind of a disadvantage, at least for the time being, and probably would call on the Palestinians to develop their own struggle in different ways, other than the usual mechanisms, politically speaking, of depending on the consensus of the League of Arab States, which includes most of the Arab countries, that used to have the traditional position of non-normalization with Israel. But certainly it does not kill the Palestinian struggle. This is a very long struggle. It's likely to take longer. And, of course, the Palestinian people, just like many others seeking freedom, they will find their way around it, despite the, disappointments that we see today.
Well, under the Pentagon scenario for the upcoming U.S. foreign policy, Trump's prospect in the Middle East have been to put Iran in the face of everyone else as an enemy while strengthening the relationship with maybe Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, while just maintaining the combative position against Iran, evidently by assassinating Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani at the beginning of this year. Is there any more room for diplomacy in this matter, given all the American warmongering rhetoric?
Well, I think there will be some kind of room, at least in the current impasse between the United States and Iran. We have to remember, in the final analysis, despite what the American administration is doing, I mean the outgoing administration, Trump's administration, has been doing over the last 4 years. We have to remember that Iran, in its geopolitical position, its the kind of influence it enjoys in the region are very vital and very important. And one day the Americans will come down to their senses somehow and find ways to deal with Iran. President Trump himself, if he wins the elections, as I predict he will, he will be embarking in kind of a diplomatic campaign, if you like, towards Iran. He has mentioned it throughout the last 4 years. Many times that he wants to deal with Iran, and Iran will find a way to work with him, despite what has been going on both sides in terms of the media. However, we have to remember one important thing here, that the Iranian overall strategy in the region might not be something that brings luxury to the American foreign policy in the area, but in the final analysis it's very essential, because it has its own allies in the area which cannot be discounted at all.
Well, moving on maybe to Libya, which is now center of the ongoing scenery in the Middle East, it represents a more complex challenge, maybe owing to the variety and crossover of U.S. interests in the country. Now, the most Trump has done during his presidency for Libya is to call for a ceasefire, though he has not been actively involved, despite the fact that his predecessor Barack Obama destroyed the country. Do you see any upcoming maybe change in handling the Libyan filed by the new U.S. administration?
Well, there should be some kind of different approach. I wouldn't say changing, because changing will be quite difficult for the overall American policy in the area, including in North Africa, where Libya is. We have to remember one important thing here, that America, since the assassination of the late general, the Iranian general earlier this year, America has been in the retreating from the area, including North Africa. And Trump has said many, many times before that he doesn't want to get the U.S. involved with any more troops. You know, when it comes specifically to the Libyan file, I don't expect the Americans to do much in terms of, you know, settling the conflict that they have initiated. They have started, as you rightly mentioned, under the Obama administration in 2011. But what I expect them to do is to embark on some kind of diplomatic, probably, campaign to supporting the United Nations mission in the country, which is leading in Libya, which is leading some kind of efforts now, you know, try to bring about some peaceful settlement into the conflict there. So other than that, I don't really expect much except the usual rhetoric we have been hearing from them about the Russian involvement as well as the Turkish involvement and many others who are key players in the Libyan conflict nowadays.
Well, it is obvious that the Middle East or the region of West Asia will not be a main focus for the U.S. On the contrary, the U.S. is expected to focus on repairing maybe the effects of COVID-19 that has been leaving enormous challenges on the United States of America internally and in foreign policy terms. Maybe they would focus on the Middle East being the fourth priority for them behind maybe Europe, the Indo-Pacific, and Latin America. Is that good news or bad news for the region? Because maybe bad news meaning leading for further control of Israel.
Well, indeed, it's some kind of a bad news. It depends how you look at it. But we have to remember one of the barrels of the U.S. Middle East policy or regional policy in our area of the world has always been and will always be the defense of Israel and making Israel superior to its neighbors in terms of military capabilities. And that's why they just keep, you know, making available to the Israelis the latest technology in military equipment. However, if the Americans are really serious about making peace and probably changing their policy approaches into the region, they have to change it, the overall approach they have been applying, at least under the administration, the current administration. We have to remember that the Iranian nuclear deal must be part of that strategy as it was under Mr. Obama, and America has to come back to that deal in some way or form. To be able to deal with the very important regional power, which is Iran in this case. Otherwise, I don't see the Iranians, you know, coming down to any kind of negotiation table, as they have said it before, many times before, through the at least the foreign ministry. Yeah, the second thing is, it's also a bad thing for the Palestinians that will, you know, apply much stress on the Palestinian society, especially in Gaza, where the boycott and the siege has been, you know, affecting people for the last decade or so. And the Palestinians, as I mentioned earlier, must have some kind of, you know, must find a different way to alleviate their misery as well as come up with some kind of political as well as diplomatic surge in their struggle, which I mentioned earlier will be long, and this is not the end of it.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mustafa Fattori, researcher and political writer and commentator, for joining us to talk about how the U.S. presidential elections of 2020 will affect the region of West Asia. Thank you for your contribution, and please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام إن السواك في السحر قبل الوضوء من السنة.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "Verily, brushing one's teeth at dawn before performing the ablution or wudu is part of recommended prophetic practice."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Now, we find a very interesting dialogue between Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam and the Umayyad Caliph Umar bin Abdul Aziz. And so in this dialogue between Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam and Umar bin Abdul Aziz, Imam al-Baqir gives some useful commandments to Umar bin Abdul Aziz about managing his government. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says to him to treat the young ones of the Muslims in society as your sons and thus have mercy on them. Treat the middle ones in age in among the Muslims in the society as your brother and treat your brother kindly. And finally, treat the old people of the Muslims in your society as your father and obey their wise sayings. Now, in reply to this statement in this dialogue, Umar bin Abdul Aziz really admired this maxim, this saying of Imam al-Baqir, and he himself in this dialogue said, "By Allah, you, Imam al-Baqir, have gathered things, accumulated things, brought things together. If we put these things into effect and Allah helps us with them, good will continue for us, insha'Allah, Allah willing." So these valuable words have brought together only political affairs, but in reality, when the head of the state rules or governs his subjects with justice and fairness and mercy and kindness and regards the people in the society as members of his or her own family, then the government and the people are happy and good continues to come for them. Very beautiful and valuable lesson, especially in today's time, and especially for political leaders and governments all around the world, that we should have a just system, we should have a fair system, we should have a kind system, we should have a merciful system, and treat the people as members of a family so that good continues to be blessed upon us all. A beautiful lesson, profound indeed, in this dialogue brought to us by Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Thank you.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
Just to let you know that when you hear these fatwa from our mujtahideen, you know, people ask this question, oh, mujtahids are giving fatwa, where does it come from? Well, the fatwa in most cases basically are based on the ahadith of the imams of the Ahlul Bayt. Or even if it's not exactly from the wordings of the ahadith, it is based on the principles derived from the Quran and the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt. And I would like to actually clarify some of the issues. I hear again and again, it's really surprising. We should have moved, you know, beyond these issues long, long time ago. The issue of food, what is halal and what is haram. And so what I've done is selected some of the ahadiths of the fifth imam, you know, just to have a general perspective of this from the perspective of the ahadith of Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salatu wassalam. Let me start with a couple of ahadiths about non-meat products. The general principle which should help us in making the decision whether this is halal or haram, when it comes to non-meat products, the guiding rule is that everything is halal for you unless you come to know it is haram. Keep this in your mind. كُلُّ شَيْءٍ لَكَ حَلَال حَتَّى تَعْلَمْ أَنَّهُ حَرَامٌ. Everything, as far as non-meat products are concerned, you start with the assumption that this is halal for you unless you find out or you come to know the opposite of that. An example here would be of food items. There was a question, somebody by the name of Abu Ayyub, narrating from Al-Kunnasi, he says, I asked the Imam, the fifth Imam, and his samni wal jubun, tajiduhu fi ard al mushrikeen fi Rum. Very relevant to our situation. This person asked the Imam about, you know, cheese and oil, which he would buy in the land of the Kufar in Rome from non-Muslims, in a non-Muslim country. And na'akuluhu, should, are we allowed to eat that? And Imam says, amma ma alimta minhu annahu qad khalatahu al-haram fala ta'akuluhu. If you know about the cheese or the oil, that something haram has been included in it, if you know about it, فَلَا تَأْكُلُهُ, then do not eat it. وَأَمَّا مَا لَمْ تَعْلَمْ, but if you don't know whether it has been mixed with haram, فَكُلُهُ حَتَّى تَعْلَمْ عَنَّهُ حَرَامٌ, then eat it. You're allowed to eat that until you come to know that it is haram. So when it comes to simple things like non-meat products, the ruling and the guiding principle is, it is halal for you until you come to know it is haram.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Decision 2020. Educational institutions in the U.S. were supposed to represent equality of opportunity, but there are still persisting inequalities at the heart of America's educational system. Hundreds of thousands of American students have been exposed to gun violence during school hours, and there's been a large number of deadly shooting incidents at American schools. Experts have also labeled the issue of student debt. That's a big problem. It's called a national crisis at this point, which is dragging down the economy, fueling the racial wealth gap, and even destroying lives. Then teachers, they're frustrated. Although their job comes with unique challenges, the majority of them earn a solid middle-class wage at best. Hello, and welcome to Decision 2020. I'm Kavit Ahmed. Yet, unfortunately, the topic we've